Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osman here on KLBB, Club 1220, for the next hour. Tom Hsu running the boards and computers in the next room. How you doing?
Hello, sir. I'm doing very well.
Quite a week we had.
It's been a long week.
It's a long week. Some more snow and cold, and then we'll talk about the heat in a few months.
I'm just glad it didn't end up like my girlfriend trying to get into work here. She spent 2 hours trying to get through from the east side of the cities over to west side of Minneapolis over on, what day was that?
Tuesday. Do you ever wonder if some snowshoes and skis just might be faster to get from place to place? I was driving on Tuesday also, and I was literally going, you know, 0 to 5, and I thought, I really could just get out, have the moment from falling down, just get out and just walk the freeway.
I know what moment that is, yeah. Only for you, you might have to put, like, chains on your shoes or something like that. Get some snow boots.
Yeah, I didn't have the galoshes that day, so it wouldn't have worked. I want to talk about something, though, that I will be promoting shamelessly the next few weeks, is Newsapalooza, an evening of history and humor at the Heights Theater on February 27th. We will have a collection of video clips, many of the clips you've heard here in Flashback Twin Cities, along with a media panel with Stan Turner of KLBB will be there. Rob Lear, Ron Rosenbaum, Tom Mischke.
Oh, wow.
It'll be a few names we recognize at this station.
Rosenbaum, too.
Be there. It'll be Brian Lambert, a media panel, and we will have clips and some video clips I don't air on terrestrial radio. And but
then might there be a couple of words?
We have a few Block E clips that I've been holding back. Block E is always a very popular thing to talk about here. To those in this side of town that don't make it to Minneapolis very often, Block E was a place that had some challenges. January 18th, on this day in history, a couple things happened. In 1985, 100 million people finally watched PBS. Now, I'm not trying to be funny here. It was the first time that 100 million viewers had actually reached the PBS system. So I want to play a little clip here. This is just a little chime. This is from the 80s. This makes me think of PBS. That was the original PBS outro chime.
I'm glad they changed it.
Yeah, it makes it feel very educational, doesn't it?
Well, that's a word that does not fully describe what I feel, but, you know.
In one show premiered 39 years ago today, I'm going to play the theme song, and let me know if you can think of what it is.
Well, we're moving on up.
Do you know what it is yet?
I admit I don't. I know the song.
Tom, you're too young for the show. The Jeffersons, 39 years ago today.
There we go. I mean, that's Nick at Night stuff, or at least when it used to play that kind of thing.
Broadcast TV when I was a youngin', but it's okay. 1975, the Jeffersons, and they were on for 11 seasons. January 1975, 39 years ago today. Who would have thought 200-plus episodes... George and Wheezy. The first time I went to Disney World, MGM Studios, as was called in those days, they had a guest celebrity every week at Disney World, and they'd be there all week. Well, mine was Isabel Sanford. She was the guest celebrity that she got to go in the parade, and one of the early Disney celebrities down there. So there you go.
You were a different child.
I can't help who the Disney company decided to have as their guest. But,
you know what? I'm right there with you. I used to watch all that stuff as well. You know, Alfred Hitchcock and all those good things that used to be on Nick at Night. And I think I'm better for it.
Aren't we all? But I want to go back to Newsapalooza. If you like tickets, go to tcmedianow.com. And you can go ahead and get a ticket from a link. And we will be maybe giving away some tickets the next 2 weeks to Newsapalooza. It'll be a fun night. Tom, you're going to be there, right?
Absolutely. I don't know what my role will be, but I'll be there.
Mostly I'm going to ask you to play clips, and then I will have you tell me how much time I have left. No, it'll be fun, but you'll be there. And Jack Stallman will be there. He's guest hosted here a couple times, so we're going to have a lot of fun.
Wonderful.
And Stan of KLBB, he'll be there, and we might even play some Stan Turner clips.
I'm sure he'll have no shortage of stories.
No shortage of stories, and then he can yell at me when I play clips he doesn't want to see. We got Randy Meyer. Randy Meyer is going to be here. Randy Meyer of Fox 9. He's been in the market for 20-plus years, and it's great to have him here today. And we'll talk with Randy after this break here on KLBB Club 1220. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond with our very special guest, Randy Meyer from Fox 9, KMSP-TV. Randy, welcome to
Flashback
Twin Cities.
Pleasure to be here.
Making the trip to Stillwater on a snowy winter day.
Yeah, it's kind of it's a little bit of a treacherous drive out there, but nothing the Jeep can't handle.
You know what, you've been in Minnesota a while now, so this is it's in your DNA now, right?
Well, I grew up in Wisconsin, so there's not a whole lot of difference there. But yeah, it's been now... I came in early 1990, so almost 23, 24 years now.
You're here for Halloween Blizzard. You mean?
Oh, yeah.
One year in and...
Covered it deeply.
Oh, everyone
right up to my knees.
The Halloween Blizzard.
Now, did you cover because you couldn't leave the station for many hours, or was it... Because you were there the weekend.
You know, yeah,
I
mean, it was over the... I think we did do an overnight, but there was just so much news to cover from that thing. Just from the standpoint of it started, you know, and I remember it so clearly because I had kids that age. We're going trick-or-treating. Like 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening, it started snowing those big fluffy flakes, and it just never stopped, you know?
You know, I remember it, you know, being at night, and you'd stay up too late on Halloween, and I thought, oh, really cool, school were canceled the next day. Well, little did we know it was going to be everything was canceled for 2 days. And
who doesn't remember those big ice chunk ruts on 94 and other interstates for the next month or 6 weeks, it seemed like.
But you've been back here now doing local news for 2 years now. We were talking before the show started. You went to New York for a while, and you've been back here doing the 5 o'clock news at Channel 9 for 2 years.
Believe it or not, it's been I left KSTP in June of 2003.
Does it feel like over 10 years?
It doesn't.
Yeah,
no,
it doesn't. I remember when you left the first time to MSNBC, and it just feels like, wasn't that last summer?
Yeah, and it was a five-year stint that it went very quickly out there. A very enjoyable time. It's a whole different world to go from, you know, this is major market news in the Twin Cities, but still going from local news to a network operation with a cable news operation involved. And my role was both on the cable side and the news operations side with the Weekend Today stuff and CNBC and some different things that I was involved with. So it was a different sort of, you know, job, same sort of skill set, but much more intense. You know, instead of doing a half-hour show locally, my show was 3 hours from 9 to noon. And you're, of course, exposed to a whole different genre of stories at that level. It's all national and international news that you're covering.
And, you know, I want to talk about that, but let's just take a step backward, though. 1990, you come to town, and you came here to do reporting and weekend anchoring at Channel 5.
That's right, yeah.
And you were from Wisconsin. And had you worked in some smaller markets prior to coming to Minnesota?
I did. I'm one of those cases that luck and circumstance got me in this business very early. I went to La Crosse, actually, at the time to play football, but I needed a part-time job, as a lot of students did. So at the time I applied, I knew I was going into journalism. Mass communications was the degree at Wisconsin. And so I applied at the local TV station, which was the CBS affiliate, WKBT. And at that time I was applying for a studio cameraman job. Basically, you operate the big studio camera before they were computerized.
Human beings in the studio.
when people actually operated them. And I actually got the job. I didn't think I would, and they didn't have an opening, but as luck would have it, I had my interview, and the next day a girl quit, and so, boom, I was in. And so I was in the studio, in the business at age 18, and I did that. Then I went out in the field and started doing the field cam. My junior year, I did an internship as a reporter.
And your back survived carrying those big cameras around.
Because this was huge. It's a way different thing. There's this big box on the side that you carried over a strap over your shoulder, and the giant Ikigami cameras that weighed, I don't know, 40 pounds or whatever they
were.
And
that was modern technology. That was a step up from the cameras that they'd had in the early 80s.
I actually shot film for one day. The second day of my job, we switched from film to three-quarter inch. And then I shot three-quarter inch for the rest of the time that I was actually doing cameras. And But I got the internship, and then I went on to become the weekend anchor my senior year in college, and so then I was sort of on my way at that point.
I got to ask, when you were just starting out as the cameraman, did you run into the old grizzled veteran who's hunched over, you know, can't look up anymore, and be like, this you're is going to happen to you.
You're not going to want to do this, young man. Pick a different career.
Oh yeah, several of those actually.
Oh, did they haze you a little bit?
I knew that was sort of a means to an end. I never thought that would be what I would do in the end. I remember standing behind that big studio camera the first day I had the job and looking out across through the lens at the set with the anchors out there, and I remember saying to myself, that's what I want to do.
Well, and that's an untraditional route to go from behind the scenes to in front of the camera. So someone must have thought that this guy is talented. This guy has some value in front of the camera as well as behind the camera.
Yeah, I think they took chances on students back then and threw us actually into real jobs more so than they would ever do today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a lot of college kids that do internships with us, but they'll never make it on the air. And I don't think they would in this day and age at the 135th market, which is what lacrosse was at the time, either. But I was able to do that, and yeah, someone saw something in me that made some sense along the way, and it worked out well.
Our guest today, Randy Meyer, I'm guessing like many others, some tapes started circulating. You probably created 25 U-matic tapes, and to give the audience a little bit of idea, 3/4-inch tapes are like VCR tapes, except they're about 2 pounds heavier and about 3 times bigger, and no one knows what to do with them today.
So it's a brick of tapes.
Yeah, but if you have one, email tcmedianow.com.
Exactly. I have a tub of them. You know, back in the day, you always would, instead of a paper resume, which is what many professionals have, our resumes were all done on videotape, 3/4-inch videotape at the time. And we would compile, oh, that was a really good story. I'm going to put that on my resume tape. So you'd compile your best work, be it anchoring, reporting, or whatever, and it would be part of a composite that you would put on this tape. And that's how you advance to the next level of our industry. And as you may or may not know, there's the industry is made up of 205 television markets. Mm-hmm. Twin Cities is about 14 these days, so it's a major market. New York 1, Los Angeles 2, and Glendive, Montana 205. So you never want to be in Glendive, Montana. So you use this tape to try and get up the market chain for your career.
And no offense to those listening in Glendive, Montana.
No, God bless you. It's a great place to start.
But, you know, a lot of people came from Duluth to work in mm-hmm. Twin Cities. You know, John Steppen, one of them, Cindy Mercado, came from bigger cities, ended up in Duluth, and then the Twin Cities, or, you know, Green Bay, the Twin Cities is a natural step. So let's talk about Channel 5. Your tape's out there, and someone at Hubbard Broadcasting or one of their consultants thought this Randy Meyer guy might work in what we're doing.
Well, yeah, there was an interesting leap in between there. So I went from lacrosse. I did the I was the main anchor in lacrosse shortly after graduating from college. Did that for a year or a year and a half there, and then I went on to Charleston, Huntington, West Virginia. Same role as an anchor reporter there. 15 months into that, my tape, resume tape, was on a pile of several hundred others, and a production company out of Sydney, Australia, called up my agent and said, we'd like to hire Randy to do an international show for what at that time was the fledgling Fox Network. We had Fox Network at that time had 5 hours of programming, period, all week long. It was, you know, Cops, The Reporters, Married with Children. Those are some of the ones that
Tracy Ullman.
Yes, exactly.
Bert the Simpsons.
And our show, Beyond Tomorrow, which was innovative, looking at things that technology, science, medicine that would be happening in your lives maybe inside the next 10 years. So I traveled around the world with four other correspondents, and I did that show. And then late in 1989, Fox got a harebrained idea that they would replace our show with another show, and we all thought, oh, this is just a disaster, because we loved that job. I mean, it was the best job in the world. We traveled. We only worked 6 months out of the year. Then we were on hiatus, and they needed an hour of programming, and what do you think happened? They put a cartoon on, and we thought, this is never going to work.
Is this the one that's been on for 25 years?
It is the longest-running show in television history in The Simpsons. So they actually knew what they were doing, and at that point is when I came to the Twin Cities.
It's made a little bit of money for your company.
They've done all right by it.
Well, I'm trying to picture, I mean, you're a young guy. You're getting paid to travel. You're not even traveling your own dime. You're going to these exotic places, and you're doing journalism. I mean, this couldn't have been any better.
I was 20, I want to say I was 25 years old at the time, 25, and I was able to, I would leave Sydney, Australia, or Los Angeles with a plane ticket that was about as fat as, you know, as your fist, and a pocket full of per diems, and we would go to Egypt or Europe or Japan or, I mean, you name it. Parts, you know, we'd come to the U.S. and do stories here as well. And it was, we'd be gone from the U.S. I think the longest I was ever away from the U.S. was 8 weeks. But then we would go back to Sydney, Australia to do our studio work and write the stories and produce the show.
Were you married then?
I was. I was married, and my wife was pregnant with our first child. And she traveled with me some. She would come to Australia because I would have extended time in Australia. I would spend weeks at a time in Australia, so she would come and visit and stay with me in Australia.
At a certain point, were you thinking, like, this job's not going to last forever? This job is too good to be true? Or was that not even a thought?
I was hoping that it would last a long time. And it was a great springboard. We were exposed to a lot of things, you know, from an entertainment programming standpoint. I was hoping that we would go longer than 2 seasons or 2 years because it was very conducive to my lifestyle, raising a family with the time off that you had, being able to see the world at a very young age. So I tried not to think about what the next thing would be. And even when we were canceled, ABC was in negotiations to pick it up, and we were hoping that that would happen. It didn't happen. And at that point, for me, local news was the closest thing, and I'd done that, so that's where we ended up.
Did you feel that was a letdown to go from this kind of international assignment to then doing what you just, you know, started out doing? And granted, you know, the Minneapolis is not a small market, but you're doing weekends and you're doing back to car chases and back to mm-hmm. fires and snowstorms.
I never felt that it was a letdown because the thing that got us over the hump on that is that it was Minneapolis. We always said, even before the Beyond Tomorrow show, that eventually we wanted to end up back in the Twin Cities because it was the closest, largest market to where my wife and I were both from. And so we were happy. I mean, I wasn't unemployed ever. The first place they sent a tape to was here, and I got a job right away. So there was never a lag in employment per se. But we were happy to be here. And if we were going to switch sort of the genre of the type of broadcasting that I was going to do, Minneapolis was the place we wanted to be.
Our guest today, Randy Meyer, talking about the early days of his career and also at Channel 5. You come to Channel 5 in 1990, and you're doing, I think, the weekends, and then you're doing the 5 o'clock news for a while. And as it's happened on Channel 5 a couple times, there's been a couple anchor shifts, and you were doing 10 o'clock for a while when Mark Spelson went to Chicago.
Right.
And then
Chris Canangle. The chapters at KSTP for me were, yes, came as a weekend anchor, a 10 o'clock reporter. Shortly after that, I suppose I did that for maybe a year or so, and then I was moved to the 5 o'clock Monday through Friday and reporting as well. And then when Chris Canangla left, Mark Sapelsa left, Chris Canangla was brought in. I was still doing the 5. He was doing the 6 and 10. Chris Canangla left. I did all of the shows at that point.
You were paired up with Colleen Needles for a brief period of time.
Angela Storr, Colleen Needles, Julie Nelson, Harris Salford.
And again, not to disrespect that broadcasting operation around town, there's just been a couple different anchor teams, and looking for that one that was going to be the long time one. And I think that when you were Julie Nelson, that was probably one of the longer lasting teams that lasted for at least 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, it was. You know what? It's the one sort of pairing that I'm often asked about by people who remember our time together. Gosh, you and Julia were good together. You know, whatever happened to that deal? And of course, you have to explain that it's a business, and Julie was hired to go to CARE, and I went to New York, so our time together was cut short. But that was the most memorable pairing in my career locally, where it resonated with people. They remembered how well we worked together. They remembered the chemistry, but circumstance had it in such that it just it wasn't meant to be.
Well, you know, in the TV business, you know, at that point in 2003, 10 years ago, and to this point now, it's becoming more challenging. And, you know, the competition is getting wider. You know, you look at when you were at Fox, and there was 5 hours of Fox programming. Fox owns several stations now. And Fox...
Ours being one of them.
And Fox has actually done, you know, I think that the traditional stations in town, we'll call them the big three, I don't think saw Fox as a challenge.
No. And in fact, I remember working, even though I'd worked for the network, the entertainment division, before coming to KSTP, we really didn't give Fox a lot of credence when I was at KSTP, when they started to delve into the news operations and had local stations and O&Os, because it was really hard for them to get a foothold in major markets because of, you know, the big three were so entrenched. And at that time, the entertainment program for the big three was entrenched. People's viewing habits are hard to turn away. You know, I think the big thing that really shifted the tide for Fox from a local standpoint was when they started to delve into sports. They got the Super Bowl. They got different things.
NFL. That's kind of where it started.
Yeah, that legitimized them in the eyes of the viewer. And then, you know, they started to put interesting local news operations on the air in some of the major markets, this being one of them. And it worked out well.
Well, you have to give, you know, both the Hubbard Company and Fox, they both want to take risks. And both want to take risks, whether it be satellite programming. And in Fox's case, you look at American Idol. American Idol is a program that I think the first three networks turned it down. And Fox picked it up, and that worked out pretty well for them,
too. It
worked
out really well for them. They've made gazillions of dollars off of that show. And you're right. And it's a good analogy. You know, the Hubbard family are innovators. They've always been innovators. They're entrepreneurs. When I worked there, one of the most interesting things about being there was that you were always, from a local standpoint, in a family-owned operation on the cutting edge of the technology that was in our business. I remember working in West Virginia, and I had a tech operator come up to me and say, "Hey, there's this family-owned operation up in the Twin Cities that just invented what's called a satellite truck, where, you know, we could drive this thing out into the boonies out here, and you can broadcast live without." And it was so strange to us to think of that back then. And I'm trying to think what year that would have been. I'm going to say it was 1985, maybe. And sure enough, it was the Hubbards, and they're innovative engineers, and they were always looking for the next, you know, greatest move in this industry, and they've done very well by that.
Our guest today, Randy Meyer. And so let's go back to 2003 now. Your Time Channel 5 is coming to an end, and you need a job, and MSNBC is the next step in your career. Was there other markets that were looking at you? Was there other spots outside of broadcasting you had thought of, and what made you go to MSNBC?
Yeah, well, when it was announced that my contract was not going to be renewed at the end of May of 2003, and I was informed, or my agent was informed, in February of the month leading into that. And so when that happens in this industry at this level, word gets out right away that so-and-so in whatever market's going to be – the contract's not renewed. They're going to be available for whatever. And within days, the agent gets contacted by different organizations. Jobs back then were easier to come by in major markets than they are today. And there were others, but MSNBC and NBC, which is the parent company – at that time, it was GE that owned the operations. They were the most aggressive. Moving to New York and doing the network thing is always on the mind of anybody who's in this business, at least most of us that are in this business. And it was an opportunity for us to go to the next level, and it was an easy decision for us.
And to put into context, I think some of this audience might have a different idea of MSNBC now than what it was in 2003.
It's much different.
Much different. It was not a political station as
no,
it is
not
now.
At all.
It was very business-oriented, you know, very hard news-driven. You know, I think that people in this audience might consider that equivalent to the Fox News is a perception. I'm going by perception here, okay? Not taking any side on this. But when you went there, it was – they were gaining traction. It was actually a new network. It had only been in existence for about 6 years.
Right. It was a much different place. We were very down the middle of the road, just absolutely just general news broadcasting from the time I went on the air in the morning until the time that primetime kicked in at 7 o'clock at night. And even our primetime programming back then, and it was still, you know, it was still Chris Matthews, and it was some of the, you know, Joe Scarborough, some of the names that are still there today.
They're doing different shows, though. They were doing shows.
That's right. They were doing more talk shows down the middle of the road, politically shows, than they are today. And I think just as I was leaving MSNBC, they made a decision to try and be the anti-Fox. And that's a business model. Mm-hmm. What do you do? What can you do to compete?
What's your niche in the market?
Yeah, and if we can be left-leaning, if the perception is Fox is right-leaning, then we can, you know, maybe we can garner a bigger audience, because I think CNN was still and still is considered somewhat down the middle with their coverage. And So there was a niche there that they wanted to occupy, and but it was not there when I was there. It's interesting to watch it now and to see some of the same people take on a different tack.
Well, I know when I see MSNBC occasionally through clips, and I look at for example, your daytime news updates, and they're trying to create an angle to a story, mm-hmm. and even the anchor, whether it be was Clarissa, what was her name, Clarissa used to do on IMS, and then she would
yeah.
do the, I remember her interviewing someone, then she kind of added her own kind of commentary to the and I don't believe you did that.
We couldn't do it. In fact, it was not allowed. Now at night at prime time, that was considered different. They certainly did lend their opinions to some of the primetime program, but we were just, it was Amy Robach and myself. Contessa Brewer, Natalie Morales.
Because Contessa, she changed. I mean, she was doing news, and then she must have got the memo. No. You got to be more controversial.
Well, she was there. She stayed there longer than the rest of us. Mm-hmm. So she was there during the change. So yeah, there was a morphing of what the latitude that she was given.
I just remember Keith Olbermann. He was a guy in ESPN, and he did some mm-hmm. did a little bit, and all of a sudden he was doing a kind of straight news show. Up and through. The first Bush administration, and then all of a sudden became a much different yeah. show.
And again, that was a shift in business model. They decided there was a market out there, and there were enough hard leaning liberals that were watching Fox News, and they were watching to throw things at the TV, and they figured they could garner some of that audience, and that was their position.
And you left then to come back to Minnesota. You missed Minnesota enough to come back and figure out what the next step in your life was. Because your family never did move completely, right?
They were there for 1 year. And, at the time we had five basic teenagers, and moving five teenage girls to New York was probably, we underestimated what the impact of that was. It was a tough transition for a few of them, and in a year into it, we decided it was just better if they came back to Minnesota, and that worked out well.
It's a great place to have a family, raise a family. I know that we were talking before the show started. When I lived in Chicago a while, people asked, wasn't that great living there? I said, well, yes and no. I mean, it's great. It's a big city. There's a lot of things to do, but when it comes down to it, I still like being at home at night, and I still like the we take here for granted. I think the lakes and the
yeah.
beauty and the trees and the fact that we can complain about traffic here, but don't even compare the traffic here
no.
in Minneapolis to any of the big cities.
I navigate from the far east side of the Twin Cities where I live to Eden Prairie every day. It's about 40 miles door to door, and I can do that, in about 40 minutes or less. You would not get that far on the East Coast or in Chicago.
No,
ever.
No. And that note, let's take a quick break. We'll be back here with our guest Randy Meyer on Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here with Randy Meyer from Fox 9, KMSP-TV. I thought of something when you're talking about your early days in TV and in college. You had the advantage that I notice a lot of younger guys who are having their first broadcasting job do not have. You don't have millions of people with digital devices recording your
right.
first day on the air and then creating these infamous moments that are living on forever in the digital sphere.
I have one, actually. You're right. Back in the day, we didn't have any of that. There was just until VHS came along and people were actually starting to record programs, there was none of that happening. I had an unfortunate circumstance, actually, several months back. You know what an IFB is. For our listeners today, I have an earpiece in my ear when I'm broadcasting. And so even though you see my face, you see me talking, and I'm doing stories, someone is almost always talking to me in my ear, or quite often is talking to me. So I'm in order to do what we do, there's part of your brain that has to continue to read the story or talk to the reporter and still listen with the other half of my brain to what the producer or what an engineer would be telling me in my ear. Well, there was an incident a few months back where I was in the middle of a story, and it was the story at Lily Lake where where those poor children got into the mudslide, and we were updating that story, and there was supposed to be VO over me, which means you hear my voice, but then there's video running. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. The video wasn't there, and at the same time, I was being talked to in my ear, and someone was giving me a cue to And I acknowledged that I could hear what they were saying, so I gave them a thumbs up. Unfortunately, the thumbs up came at the exact same time I was talking about the children having passed away. And the firestorm, it wasn't a lot of people, but a lot of people saw that, and it was confusing to them, as you can imagine, and they couldn't understand how anybody could be so insensitive. What they didn't understand, and most people at home don't understand, is that there's a thousand things going on when I'm on the anchor desk, and the unfortunate circumstance there and coincidence was that there was supposed to be video over me at the time, so no one would have seen that I was giving the producer the thumbs up, that I was acknowledging the next direction. Instead, the viewers saw me talking about, you know, children that had passed away in a mudslide with and giving the camera a thumbs up. Those are the kind of things that would go unforeseen or forgotten pretty easily years ago. Today, in a heartbeat, it's, you know, it's on YouTube.
And I was listening to a broadcaster before on the radio, and they were mentioning, it seems like all of last year was the year of no second chances. If anything went wrong or you made a mistake on television, it seemed like that was just it. You're gone.
Well, yeah, and there were some pretty big-time mistakes that were made by some young broadcasters,
yes,
who forget that the camera's always on and the mic is always on. And that is, those are the first two things that you learn. And that was my mistake a few months back, was for someone who's been doing it as long as I've been doing it, I can see out of the corner of my eye video rolling.
Sure.
And so I know when video's rolling. And there was video rolling. Unfortunately, it was in the monitor behind me, and it wasn't full screen.
But then how are you supposed to acknowledge, you know, your next direction, like you said,
right,
without any kind of physical action?
Yeah, and we're doing that all the time. And it just the circumstances that came together at that moment created that moment, and there's just no getting away with it. And how you deal with that is important. I got a very long, terse email from a gentleman, and then we communicated, and unfortunately, he had already posted, or someone had already posted on YouTube, so there was no getting that back at that point. It was posted on YouTube, and, you know, they were calling for my head and all this other stuff. It's all of the viewers that I've ever dealt with, every single one of them. If I respond to their concerns, they're always pleased by that, and they're satisfied by that. And for him, it went away because he understood now. He understood what actually happened. But the YouTube video is already out there.
Oh, yeah. They don't expect you to come back and talk to them like a human being.
They rarely do. The first thing out of the in the response, be it Facebook or email, is that, oh, I never expected you to write me back.
How many emails do you get a day?
Oh, well, less today than, you know, before social media. Before social media would be hundreds. Before email, it was phone calls. Today, most of the correspondence that I get is via Facebook or Twitter. So that's displaced the number of emails that I get.
And how many letters do you get?
I don't get two letters a month anymore. It's all done electronically.
I think that,
and it used to be several a day.
Well, and we've had this conversation on the show a couple times with people that have been able to, you know, work in both the, you know, the pre-digital age. And in fact, I think the digital age started 5 years ago. I don't think it started 10 years ago. I think that the fact that people have had mobile devices, that they've had been able to, you know, when you write a letter, and I didn't write a lot of letters to celebrities or to people on the news, but
not a lot,
but some, you know, some did, and then they're, you know, they're upset. They go back. When you have to actually write that letter, either your aggression kind of fades away, or that, I got it, I have to, like, you know, go do that, put it in the mailbox. But this, you know, between Twitter and Facebook, any kind of aggression or, you know, emotion, it's right out there.
And it gets out there quickly. I mean, you can hammer something out. We've all been victim to it, and we've all probably done it when we shouldn't have. Hammer something out in an email or a tweet in a moment of angst, and then you go, oh, I wish I hadn't done that.
And it's permanent, too. It's permanent.
Yeah. There's none of that countdown from 10
right
type situation.
Yeah.
Do you think that, and let's talk a little bit about, you know, news gathering, and you're still a reporter, still a journalist. What I find funny is these hoaxes that go around, these stories that look really well, you know, really well written or really well produced, that, you know, float on the internet, and then news operations pick them up and go with them. Do you find that with all the clutter that's out there right now, that, you know, reporting and journalism is, granted, it's faster to get stories out there, but do you find that it's harder, or do you find that somehow we're kind of losing checking our sources and checking our facts sometimes to get the story out there?
Yeah, it's faster. It's easier to get burned today than it would have been in the electronic age of a decade or more ago, because so much of what we do now is done through Twitter. You know, the day of the exclusive is gone. The day of having a story that you're holding until 10 o'clock because your reporter has done their homework, they've dug deeper, they've got the sources, and those sources have responded, are gone. Because as soon as you get the story now, you tweet it out because you want to be the first one out. As soon as it's tweeted, everybody has it. So the evening newscasts, I think more than ever before, are very similar in their content today in most news operations all around the country. If you did a story-by-story account of the four stations here in the Twin Cities, you'd be amazed at how almost identical they are on a nightly basis, and that is because the world of Facebook and Twitter has homogenized the stories that we're all covering.
Well, the stories don't need to be covered in the news anymore. I mean, think about it. Even in 1990, when you started Channel 5, there was two editions of the paper. There was three editions of most of the newscasts at night, and that was what people got. And it was printed news. And I joke today about newspapers. It's who wants to pay, for dead trees for yesterday's news?
Yeah.
When a lot of this content is available for free online. And then, a lot of people, my age, they watch local news at the gym because it's on at Lifetime. They watch it, they display it. They watch the stories on the web. They mm-hmm. watch when they thankfully your station puts highlights online. But, people coming home at...
We stream live now as of 2 weeks ago.
So that's great.
Our broadcasts are all streaming live.
MyFox9.com.
There you go.
MyFox9.com. And I think right now, just people's work habits. I mean, people are working until 7, 8 o'clock mm-hmm. at night. They're holding down two jobs. That traditional come home at 5 o'clock and watch, it's changed.
Those days are absolutely gone. And that is the biggest challenge that traditional broadcast news has today and will continue to have. And that is, we had a collective audience at 5, 6, and 10 o'clock. We had a collective audience in the morning when people were getting dressed and getting ready to go to work. Our collective audience now consists of a demographic that is every day getting older. And when I look at my own daughter's viewing habits, I don't believe they will ever sit down at 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening and watch a traditional broadcast. They're going to get all their information on that smart device. And, of course, imagine what that smart device is going to be 5 years from now. So the challenge in our industry is how do we monetize, mm-hmm. that new world, and how do we still get enough eyeballs collectively on us at a given point in the day to make it make sense for advertisers?
Well, people still need accurate information. That's one thing I think that, people are still going to rely on traditional.
And they like it spoon-fed.
They do.
They really do. We like to – it's interesting to me. We'll sit there and read a story online, and you'll see the words, and you'll see the headline. But when you – there's something about seeing a face or seeing pictures and having it delivered to you, they want that. They still want that. And that's sort of the security that I feel that we're still going to have jobs a decade or more from now.
Even if that spoon feed is as long as it takes to read the article,
exactly,
they'll still do it.
Yeah.
Well, I was in, not to, Joe and this down this road, but I when Rick Pitello, he left Channel 11 to do this website, I thought, well we have enough websites, but he's done exactly what you're talking about. He's I got the content from mm-hmm. the right sources, put it onto a homepage for people. They don't need to do their own navigating, and that's what people want. People want the headlines. They want enough synopsis because I think people have a short attention span. If I'm on a bus or somewhere and I'm reading a story,
you're talking about Rick Capuccella's.
Yes. And I
bring me the news
exactly. And I go to StarTribune.com and I read the first three paragraphs. Okay, I got the gist of it. Okay, the dome lawsuit or the stadium lawsuit's going on now. Okay, mm-hmm. got mm-hmm. it.
The thing it's almost a menu of options that we give people, and that's what's different on the. On the electronic side versus the broadcast side, we still decide in our editorial meetings what those newscasts are going to look like. We decide what the lead's going to be. We decide what the first 10 stories are going to be. We decide when we go to weather, when we go to sports. When you get it online, people are making their own decisions, and they'll float through and say, I don't really care about that story. Ooh, that one's interesting. They'll read that one. They'll float by two more. They'll find one they like. That's our competition these days. People can cherry pick the stories they want. Now, as a journalist, the pitfall with that is pretty obvious to me. It's not obvious to the younger generations who have grown up that, and that is they're only being exposed to stories that they like or want to be exposed to, and that's not necessarily the best education for anybody. Our job as journalists was to educate people on all fronts so that they could make decisions about who they would vote for, where they wanted to live, the schools they'd send their children to. But if you're cherry-picking only the stories that please you in that kind of environment, on an online environment, you're missing a lot of stories that can educate you and help you make better decisions about the basics of your life. And that's where I think we're losing that part of journalism.
No, I tend to agree. And one question I want to ask you about, just about, you know, about Fox 9. I think that people sometimes unfairly paint a broad stroke over the broadcast organizations. And so the Fox organization, you're looking for a right-wing conservative mouthpiece. Do you get that a lot? I know people are not as brave to say to people's face.
They're pretty brave about it. No, and that is the misnomer. You know, we're an owned and operated television station. But Fox News is an entirely different entity. Fox News is their cable operation. It's a different operation than the O&Os. We are just as normal and down the middle as any other local news operation, and that's what we're supposed to be. I can look anyone in the face and tell them that there's no one in New York telling us that we need to cover certain stories and do them a certain way just because there's a Fox in front of our nine. It's a separate entity. You know, the business model of Fox News or the business model of MSNBC is simple. We're a political organization. We're going to broadcast political stories, and people are going to perceive them through their own political prisms, and they're going to, you know, make their own judgments. But the owned and operated stations or the affiliates, the Fox stations around the country, have nothing to do with Fox News Channel. In fact, if Fox News Channel broadcasts something and we see it and we like it and would like to run it, we have to jump through fire to even get our hands on it. That's how separate the organizations are.
And that's why I think Fox is successful here in Minneapolis. And I think that a lot of we talked about this before, the traditional broadcasters did not take a lot of take the Fox seriously when it came in. It used to be at UHF on 29, mm-hmm. and then Channel 9 and 29 switched bands. And,
right.
In some cases, it has beaten some longtime traditional institutions here in town, and it's been very successful. You came back in 2011. How did that go? You had been out of broadcasting for a couple of years, mm-hmm. and what made you or what made that connection back to the daily broadcast?
I think, you know, when I came back from New York, I didn't really know. At that point, I didn't know if I wanted to go back into local news, and so there was an adjustment period. I didn't really know what I wanted to do.
You want to stay here, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I did. My kids were very entrenched in high school at that point. You know, I thought about buying a business, getting involved in the business world, and I never found anything that sort of tripped my trigger in that front. And it occurred to me, I did a couple things, went back out to New York and did some work for WCBS, anchored for them for a couple weeks on vacation relief, did some stuff at WCCO Radio here, and realized that that's really where my heart was. You know, I think in any profession, you know, and I say this because I think when you get to a certain age, you understand yourselves better. You know what you're good at, and I think to not do what you're good at, I felt like I was shortchanging. I knew that when I went into the studio or when I went into the newsroom, I felt good every day. I think that's a very important part of any job, is to feel good about getting in the vehicle and driving to work.
So you're happy when you go to work every
day? Oh, I just love it. I really am. People go, you're crazy. It's stressful. It's this, it's that. I don't find what I do the least bit stressful. Now, that's not true for everybody in our industry because it is very competitive and it's very – not everybody wants to be in front of thousands of people talking, or every mistake you make is right there for people to see. But I don't think of those things, and I really just enjoy the whole element of doing that. And that's a special thing. I don't know a lot of people that get to say that when they go to work.
Married with five children, any of them into broadcasting?
Not a single one.
you've scared them away.
And
from
no, this. I don't. I think they've, you know, they've had a very good life to this point because of this career. None of them are afraid of it. None of them. Are bothered by the fact that people know who I am when I walk around the cities. It just never really fell in any of their wheelhouses. You know, my oldest is studying to be a police officer. I've got one that's an engineer, one that's a school teacher, one that's going into the dental field, and one that, you know, is probably going to be in advertising or something like that. She's still in college. So it just never really fell within their passion area.
Is it a constant learning curve right now with Twitter and Facebook? You're doing this daily now. You know, it's, mm-hmm. it's expected of you to be part of social media and be able to interact with the audience.
Yeah, it is. It's a new element of what we do. But I think over the, you know, in my 30 years of doing this, there's always been some new element that's come through a web page. You know, it was you know, the ease of broadcasting live. It was, you know, just things that occur over time that increase the scope of your job. This is another one. I would say the place that it's most taxing for me is, you know, they like us to tweet during a newscast. There's a lot going on during a newscast, you know, especially if I'm anchoring it by myself, which is how I do the 10 o'clock at night. So, you know, tweeting during a newscast is challenging, but we do it. And the audience seems to, at least some elements of the audience, seem to appreciate the fact that, that we do it. Although I guess I would acknowledge that if they're getting tweets, they're probably not watching the newscast. So I'd rather have them watching the newscast. But
well, you know, there's people like me that I can do have about three different screens open and my phone on, yeah, and have the TV on and drive. No, just joking. No,
yeah,
I don't,
no,
do that,
I know you're out there.
Yeah, yeah, right. And do you find that, I mean, are you enjoying this connection with viewers? I mean, we talked about before, you had the letters, you know, but now you're talking right away. And I, yeah, think that you said they're surprised when you're replying back to them.
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest, you talked about the difference between doing the network stuff with NBC and MSNBC. The daily contact with the viewers was not there at the network level. You're instead of thousands of people, you're broadcasting to hundreds of thousands of people. And it's not a local, they don't attach to you locally. In the local markets, you do have a daily contact with your viewer. And now with social media, you have a more immediate and personal contact with the viewer. And for the most part, I do enjoy that. I will say that of all the places I've been, Minnesota, the folks here are the kindest in terms of approaching you about, hey, aren't you so-and-so, and I watch you. Other parts of the country, I've been – not so much.
Well, we're a unique market in the fact that we're very news conscious here, and you've worked in other markets in New York. We take it very seriously, and plus the people that we watch, we take them very seriously too.
Mm-hmm.
Bigger markets don't have magazines like Minneapolis-St. Paul that have so many, you know, profiles and articles or shows like this one about people that have been in the media. And I think that's something that people are surprised when they come here for that brief job that lasts 20 years,
mm-hmm,
or that have left here. It's a very, I mean, we're not L.A., we're not New York. In New York, they kind of grind them and leave them.
Well,
LA,
you are kind of a shock jock, that's for sure, Tom.
I'm a shock jock. Get the where's the bell? Okay, there we go.
All right.
Thanks, you. In L.A., they got other celebrities and cars.
Well, that's the thing. You're right, Tom. In Minnesota, we have athletes and news people. Those are the celebrities of the Twin Cities and really of Minnesota. And that does elevate our profile to a different level than it might be in another city or another place. But, you know, it's good. I think we do have people that's come here and stay here a long time, spend their whole broadcast careers here, and that's pretty unique in that industry.
Do you get the weird stare if you're ever at the grocery store or at a restaurant where people are like, I think I know him from somewhere, but I'm afraid to say something or I'm afraid to look him in the eye?
You get that all the time, but I'll tell you what I do, and I apologize ahead of time to any ladies out there who may have been exposed to this, but I'll get that from women my age once in a while. And I'll call them out on it, and because you can always tell they're trying to place you, they haven't quite figured it out, and I'll say, you don't remember that night, do you?
Oh.
And I'm telling you what, more times than not, they think that I'm dead serious and that there was something there at some point in time, and it is, and I just let them go. I just let them drift away into the grocery aisle or whatever.
You know, walk away with a smile on your face.
The gossip columnist in town one of these days is going to pick up on that. It's going to be a front page story. Randy Myers, CD passed. You know, I tried in the Dairy Queen down the road here. I tried that with my voice, like when I ordered a Sunday. It has not worked. But I'm working on that. Randy, thank you for being on the show today.
Sure, my pleasure.
MyFox9.com. And what's your Twitter handle?
Randy Meyer at Fox9.
Randy Meyer at Fox9. We'll have you back again someday on a day that it's not snowing and you can park your vehicle in without.
Yeah, I did okay. It was not a problem at all.
Appreciate it. This is Flashback Twin Cities. This is Tom Osmond. We'll be back next Saturday here on KLEB Club 1220.